This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, we have a new direction to go in, the beginning of one. We've talked to many experiencers over the course of this show's life since 1998, hundreds, maybe more. But today's experiencer is a different kind of experiencer in a way. He comes from a military background and in a defense-related background, and he has yet come out and said, I'm a close encounter witness. We're going to talk about that, and hopefully over the next few months, more close encounter witnesses who have similar backgrounds will come on Dreamland and talk to us experiencers. I'd like to welcome Dr. John Blitch to the show. He has had an extraordinary career. I would say it is a career in life-saving and helping others, basically. Dr. Blitch is a cognitive psychologist. He is presently a senior research scientist at the 7-11th Human Performance Wing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, in cognitive psychology and neuroscience. His focus is autonomy in human-robot interaction and the training of unmanned system operators and supervisors. He has had 5 tactical command tours in nuclear artillery, special operations, hostage rescue. He's been involved in DARPA and has been present after the World Trade Center attacks in 2001, Oklahoma City, and during the Katrina rescues. And I would like to welcome you now to the show, John. Here's a man whose life focus is humanitarian issues and the survival of people in trouble, and who is also an abductee.
Well, thank you very much, Whitley. That was really something. One point of correction, I think. So I'm no longer assigned to the 7-11th Human Performance Wing. I did retire from the Air Force Research Lab a while ago. So that part's a little bit dated, but thank you for the rest of that. That was wonderful.
Okay, well, I'm glad. Let's start, and we're not gonna really go into John's work so much, because this is his, unlike people like David Grush or Jake Barber, John is not, his work experience and his close encounter experience are two separate things. I want to begin, and I'm going to get into the why of this in a little while, but I want to set the scene by asking you something about your childhood, because I know from long experience, and of course I've watched your interviews, so I know in your case for certain, childhood is where this started for you.
Yes, that is what I believe. As I mentioned in a couple of other interviews, I do have quite a few terrifying dreams that I considered to be dreams until sort of the threshold event that I could no longer dismiss as a dream because it was independently corroborated. So as a scientist, I can't dismiss that as dreams anymore. So yes, I did have quite a few interesting activities, I guess, or interesting experiences as a kid.
A dream that wasn't a dream. That's what a lot of experiencers call that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about, there was one in particular that I've heard you mention before, when there was something or someone looking in the window at you. Can you go back to that one?
Yeah. So the most terrifying aspect of this, and you've discussed this many times, are those dark eyes staring through the window or getting very close to you, like, you know, literally in your face or in your grill, as we would say in the special ops community. And I, you know, looking back on all this after 65 orbits around the sun, approaching 66 here next month, that there's it seems to me that it's a control mechanism, that there's some sort of directed energy that is coming from those eyes, whatever is behind those eyes, that is paralytic in nature, but it's selective. And what I know now from my career with the Air Force Research Lab and CogSci and dabbling in neuroscience is that with directed energy, you know, you can selectively influence different parts of the brain. So it's not inconceivable for me to believe a lot of the literature, the so-called woo-woo literature. So I talk about the woo-woo abduction literature, right? I know we've both read quite a bit about.
Well, I've written some of it myself, so yeah.
Absolutely, I give a lot of it by yourself. I got all your books. And so that's in my, if we were in my basement, my library that's still under construction, I have all those books on one side, and then I have all my peer-reviewed classic science books, you know, my dad's physics books, my physics books, all the chemistry, all that stuff from engineering days. And so what I'm finding now is there's a big overlap in these. And a lot of folks are surprised, you know, the folks that have been read in, Dave and Lou Elizondo and Jake, and they don't see my jaw drop when they talk about, from their perspective, earth-shattering events, like this notion that these beings through their eyes might be able to project directed energy and paralyze us somehow. So there's plenty of evidence of that, right? And it makes all the sense in the world as an efficiency mechanism, right? So rather than floating you out of your bed like they did with a lot of children, as you get older and your brain develops enough, then what they can do is selectively paralyze you and then free up the motor control area, which is typically along the top of your cortex up here. The motor cortex runs pretty much in the middle of your brain on a band like that. So that's what I believe now based on all of my training. But that was the most terrifying aspect. Those eyes that could absolutely paralyze me.
Yeah, you're speaking here to the converted, because yeah. Probably most of the listeners of this show have had that experience, or many of them. And of course, I have too. And it's very disturbing because it can go even deeper. It feels like they can penetrate into your being. Look inside you. And how do you respond to that? Have you ever had that feeling when you were a child, you looked into their eyes, I think, or at least you had a dream that suggested that.
Absolutely. And there were, you know, looking at this scientifically from a behavioral science aspect, and a lot of us feel this way, that we thought all kids acted like this, right? And it's not until you have more social interactions with people and then you realize, well, not every kid has these nightmares about these big-eyed bugs. So examples of anomalous behavior for me, terrified of deer and squirrels. Why? Because of the solid black eyes with no pupil in them. And deer are prey animals. They're afraid of everything, right? So why would I be afraid of something that's afraid of everybody else? Clearly, deer are more afraid of me than I am of them. But it was those solid, dark eyes that would just terrify me. And so my parents were kind of, what's going on here? This doesn't really make sense. So there's one aspect of childhood that was very anomalous. What, this kid is afraid of Bambi? What the heck is going on here, right?
Yeah, well, I was afraid of Mr. Peanut for the same
Mr.
reason.
Peanut. Oh, there's yes. Parents,
what are you doing, Mr. Peanut? Go away. We don't respect your fear. Now you grew up next near a nuclear reactor site, as I recall from you.
Well, so I was born next to a nuclear reactor site.
Yeah.
And my dad moved us as soon as I was old enough to move. So this was 1959. And it wasn't, moving then wasn't as easy as moving now. There was a lot of, and child care for my mom was a big deal, right? And so it took him, I think we moved about 6 months after that. And then my dad went to work shortly for Bendix Corporation. I think it was in Bakersfield, California. So we moved from Idaho Falls to Bakersfield. And then my older sister had a very traumatic experience. Her best friend was run over by a semi-tractor trailer right in front of our house and dragged down the street.
Oh, my God.
And so, I think that contributed to us moving again very quickly thereafter. And we went to, I think we lived for about a year or so with my dad's dad in Tallahassee, Florida, where my younger sister was born. And then we finally settled down up in Boston. My dad got a job with MIT. He was a professor, got a job with Draper Laboratories, and he was an adjunct professor, I guess. He had three master's degrees, which in those days was sufficient to become a professor. Nowadays, you really can't teach much of anywhere without a PhD.
Right.
But he had plenty of technical background. And so I actually grew up in the Boston area. I don't have a lot of memory, obviously, 6 months old, of Idaho Falls, of any of that. But he was very upset one day when they had a drill, an emergency response drill, where they were practicing that something bad had happened inside the reactor. And he went running out to the guard shack, and the guard was talking to his girlfriend on the phone and refused. My dad's banging on the window to play part of this drill, and he needed to call by the checklist or whatever. And the guy just refused to let him use the phone. So he said that was it. Now, that's the story he always told me. I wonder if there was some other level of intuition that he had, because, let me see. So we moved, I was born in March. I think we moved in early fall of 59. Less than 18 months later, the first nuclear accident, first lethal nuclear accident in the United States occurred right there in that reactor. And now it is memorialized in the book Idaho Falls. It was declassified. Three soldiers were killed almost immediately. One was impaled in the dome, the inside reactor vessel. So a horrific situation. So it was almost prescient of him to figure out that we need to get the heck out of there.
You know, that's fascinating. And it's going to become clear why I was so interested in it in a minute. You were then also involved in at a command level in the nuclear artillery program, which would be missiles. You were basically commanding a flight of missiles.
Yeah. So actually my nuclear career started out pretty much as soon as I graduated from West Point. I went through Ranger School and did some other training, basic officer training for cannons. And so in those days, in 1982, by the time I ended up getting to my first assignment which was in Germany, Cold War, East Germany, West Germany. And I ended up at a nuclear capable artillery battalion. So we had cannons. They looked like tanks. They were self-propelled artillery, 155 millimeter cannons, self-propelled. And we would practice launching nuclear projectiles into East Germany from West Germany. And so I had a big issue with that. I had a sort of a sudden, maybe an epiphany, a wake up while I was walking the gun line at one point. And I do remember, you know, the clouds parting. It was a blizzard in Grafenwehr, Germany. And those folks that have ever served in the army in Grafenwehr, Germany know what I'm talking about. It is bone chilling cold. But as the battery XO, I had to police the gun line and make sure that everything was, you know, straight and strack and so forth. And this blizzard suddenly lifted. It was bitterly cold, and then there's this very bright moon shining down, and I kept a cassette recorder with me, and so I have a tape that I recorded. And I'm lamenting to myself, dude, what are you doing? There are a bunch of people 35 kilometers away, maybe a little bit further, that you are practicing killing with nuclear weapons. And they never did anything to you. They both speak the same language, for crying out loud. It's East Germany, West Germany. What the heck are we doing? And then it suddenly occurred to me, wait a minute. It's way worse than that. Because the radiological effects of these weapons are going to carry into the next generation. So we're not just killing them. We're killing their kids. We're killing their grandkids. We're poisoning this entire territory. So this is ludicrous what we are practicing doing. And so that occurred, I think, probably about 6 months before I was due to rotate out anyway and go back to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And so I applied to become, I really wanted to become an astronaut. That was my main goal. My eyes weren't good enough within the Army. And I've got another long story about that. But anyway, so I ended up applying to the Navy for an in-service transfer and was accepted. To my shock, I took a flight aptitude test, and I was just absolutely fortunate beyond words, total luck, that I got a maximum score on that. And so I landed the one NFO slot out of 14 for that fiscal year. And so I was going to the Navy. I had interviewed, I had baptized my youngest daughter in Pensacola Bay, interviewed with them, and I had my orders in hand. And then this lieutenant called me from the Navy Annex, and he informed me that they had to revoke those orders. That's very rare. You know, there's a lot that happens before you get orders, but usually in the military, and I know you are aware of this from some of your lineage. I didn't realize until I was just watching your interview with Jesse that your dad was in the Air Force.
Right. Well, my dad was in the Army, and my uncle was
Army Air Corps, maybe.
But they were both involved in intelligence work, and my uncle all of his career, and my dad during World War II, and possibly afterwards, we don't know, because he was so tight-lipped. He taught us to keep secrets. He said, you got to learn how to keep your lip zipped, because you don't want to say anything out like most people do. You want to think about what you say before you say it. That he lived that. And we're going to take a little break now, folks. We'll be right back. We're talking to John Blitch. Dr. Blitch is a... is a close encounter witness who has also been extensively involved in, you've got a security clearance, I believe, John, of course you do. Yeah. And but your primary focus has been essentially rescue operations. But I want to go to something that you might've thought at the time you needed rescue from, which is a missing time experience. And that, I think, is what, if I'm not wrong, what began to focus this a little bit in your mind, the idea of being a close encounter witness. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm going to close the loop on my nuclear part of the career, though, because I ended up going back to Fort Sill after that Navy transfer was canceled. I ended up commanding a Pershing II missile battery. So that was an Army missile. It was not Air Force.
Okay, well let's go there for a while, and I'll table the question I started with, and we'll go back.
Okay.
Because the reason I keep coming back to the nuclear issue is that our visitors or NHI are very interested in nuclear issues, and I thought to myself that you had those dreams when you were living near a nuclear site, and I thought, my God, I wonder if they knew even then that he would be involved with nukes in the future. They could have. I mean, you'd never know what they know. They're very mysterious, and their relationship to time is not like ours. It's different.
Right. Yes. So we, you know, I got together last summer with a collection of what we call nuke ex brothers, nuclear experiencers, brotherhood, small group of us who have all been experiencers. And it was, we held it at Robert Hastings' house because he wrote that book, UFOs and Nukes, and essentially
right.
brought us all together, right? As I was the only one that wasn't in the book that he had met before. But in any case, we ask ourselves that question around the campfire. You know, there's things you'll talk about as a military person around a campfire, you won't tell anybody anywhere else, right? And so we kick that around. And we all wonder, it's a chicken egg, right? Did we get into nukes before we had these, because of these childhood experiences, and they wanted us for some reason to get in there to maybe influence it in a particular way? Or were we taken because our bodies were contaminated from proximity to it, or because of our involvement? And so we're still, it's unclear, but those are kind of interesting issues to consider, right?
Was Terry there, Terry Lovelace?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Okay, so it was you and Robert and Terry and some others. You don't have to say their names if you don't want to. I mean, I
oh,
know
they have no trouble with me. Mario Woods, Terry Lovelace, Jeff Goodrich, Bob Jacobs, and Robert Hastings. So that was the core five, and then there were some other folks that came in.
Yeah, but it was that's a very interesting thing to do. So you guys are well aware of this, of what's going on here, obviously. That's really fascinating to me. I did not know that. I'm going to get Robert back on the show at some point. And
please do. Yeah.
Terry has been ill lately, and I don't know he'll come back. But they're both. In fact, what an incredibly accomplished group of men, and not of also all experiencers, all connected in one way or another with nuclear programs. I find that remarkable.
Yeah, I do too. It's absolutely fascinating. And we just added another member. I'm not going to say his name because I haven't gotten his permission yet, but this just happened like within days ago. He was a submariner. He was a submarine nuclear missile technician. And so he reached out to Robert, and we have embraced him. And so he'll probably get involved in this as well and may come out as another whistleblower. We'll see.
Well, we have a lot of people in the IC, in the intelligence community, who watch this show or listen to it, and probably maybe there's some who have similar work experience who would like to contact you. So how would they do that?
So I just stood up a new website called Fear Fighter. I think it's still under construction, but I have an email that I use for this particular subject area. I have one they use for robotics and other stuff, but for this particular aspect of fighting the fear of an alien invasion, like just like fighting the fear of killer robots, which is my other side of my life and the rescue side of that, it's fearfighter, all one word, 05 at protonmail.com.
Yeah, you're a proton mail person too.
Yeah, a lot of us. I mean, there's this notion that, Big Brother is spying on us, and it's nice to know that this stuff's encrypted on both ends. So a lot of us use proton mail.
I agree, absolutely. Now let's get back to the missing time experience.
Sure. Okay, so that occurred. The most profound one that I can't dismiss as dreamscape or whatever occurred when I was in graduate school, the first time through graduate school. I had completed five command tours. Four of those were in special operations, and I had been selected to go to the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. It's right on the border. So anyway, they told me that I was a burned out commando. I needed to work on healing my family after all that time in the trenches. So they sent me to the Colorado School of Mines to study artificial intelligence and robotics. And my buddies joked that the reason they picked me was because that was the only way I was going to get intelligent, was artificially, right? So maybe they were looking for, one of the Elon Musk inserts or whatever, and turn me into a Borg or whatever. So it happened while I was there, and it was shortly after I had returned from the Oklahoma City bombing rescue recovery effort. And I had sort of established a sort of a resilient PTSD thing. Even this was before we even knew, before PTSD really had a name, right? We called it shell shock and such. I would ride my mountain bike for about 45 minutes up to this park and sit on this on these concrete picnic tables and meditate in under the shadow of this gorgeous ridgeline of the Rocky Mountains, snow covered, beautiful. I used to consider it looked like the side of a Coors Light beer can, right? So that's what I would do. And so I had done it probably four or five times since getting back from Oklahoma City. And this just was another time. And there was a Indian burial ground that I had ridden by many times. I have some apparently some Native American blood. My great grandfather on my mom's side took a Sioux wife, and she had, told me some of that background, and I had always been very, very respectful of Native Americans. So it was extremely odd, kind of like, being afraid of deer, this anomalous behavior that I was all of a sudden compelled, obsessed, that I had to get over this fence. There was a barbed wire fence, and a gate, and I felt like I had to get over that gate, and to do what? I don't know. It was middle of the afternoon, and so I found myself climbing over this gate, and I get back on the other side. I kind of snagged my shirt a couple places, and finally made it down to the ground, and I was about to climb back in the saddle of my bike, and I realized, that's just not right. You need to be respectful while you're in here. So I walked my bike down and something dripped off of my nose. I thought it might have been sweat. And I realized, wait a minute, it wasn't a hard ride. And I was coming downhill anyway. So why would it be sweat? And then I noticed it was blood. And so I suddenly had this bloody nose. And so I walked a little bit further down this dirt road around a corner, and I laid out on this like little grassy area around this corner, and I was out. It was weird. It wasn't, like that. I wasn't tired. It
You
was just a sudden.
this behavior at this point,
Say
and
that.
recognizing it at the moment, of course.
Yeah.
Later, yeah.
I didn't recognize it at that point, at all. What I And so I woke up shivering. And it couldn't have been, I'm analyzing this now after the fact. At the time, I was like, well, I couldn't have been out for more than what, 20 minutes? Why am I so cold? And the sun's come down. And so I must have been out for at least a couple hours because now it's after sunset. I didn't realize how far after sunset, but it was many hours because it just doesn't get, Denver is kind of a desert-like environment, but it's not instantaneous. And so there had to be at least 2 hours until the sunset. And it was long after that before it got chilly, but none of that was in my head. But what was in my head was this light that was off to my right up on this mesa, and I was like a moth to the flame. And it made no sense. I didn't get back. I didn't pick my bike up and continue walking down the dirt road. I got up and grabbed my bike and dragged it probably 60, 70 feet up this super steep embankment, almost cliff-like, to get up to the top of this mesa because there was this collection of bright lights up there. And I thought maybe it was a drilling operation because, I'm at the Colorado School of Mines, right?
Right.
And so I had this curiosity, but it was beyond curiosity. I know what normal curiosity is like, and I am a pretty curious guy, but this was beyond that because even if I was curious, I would have walked the bike around on this dirt road and try to see, find a different way up. It was a weird obsession of some sort. Anyway, I get up on the top there, and after I kind of pick myself up and drag my bike up, I notice what looks like, I guess, a fuel truck. It was a shiny, like long trailer looking thing. It was either a fuel truck or maybe a milk truck. I've seen, milk trucks with super shiny, like chrome external, and I realize now that that's just to keep it cool, right? Same with fuel, right? You don't want fuel to heat up either. Either way, I walked around to the front of this very gingerly. I was very apprehensive, and I remember when I kind of got towards the cab, I looked up, and in the cab was this somebody with a red, like plaid shirt. And that's as much as I remember. I remember from that point, then suddenly becoming terrified. And I felt like some time had passed, but maybe not. I just wasn't clear. It was all fuzzy. And so I worked my way back to the back of that fuel truck. There were further lights. There were a bunch of lights like off to the front of the truck where I thought like the headlights of the truck might be. Like there might be some other vehicles over there, but I didn't want to go anywhere near that. So I turned around and went around the back of that fuel truck and got my butt out of there. And I was sneaking. I didn't want whatever was over there, whoever the people were in those other vehicles that were gathered there, I didn't want anybody to see me. So I was kind of slinking down and dragging my bike through this scrub brush, scrub oak, which is really rigid and stiff, and it was kind of tearing on my legs. And as soon as I got to the road, I jumped on that bike and I pedaled like a madman to get the heck out of there. And so from there, I ended up going down a hill. And I was going to pull over into this ranch house because I saw a light on. And speaking of lights, should I turn this on maybe? It's getting dark here. How's that? That's probably too much. How about, is that any better? Okay. So anyway, I go down this hill and I realize I'm starting to settle down now. I'm starting to get control of my fear. And I realized, I really need to call my wife because it's obviously later than I ever imagined it would be when I stopped from my bloody nose. So I went down this dirt road or dirt driveway, and I was going to go up and ring the doorbell and ask them if I could use their phone. You know, this is 1995, no cell phones. And so I stopped myself because I suddenly realized there's no lights on. There's the outside light that every rancher uses, right? Just to welcome folks in, I guess, or whatever. But I'm not going to wake everybody up. And that was my first real strong indicator that something is really wrong here because it's way late. And so then I rode back out, and thankfully it was downhill to get to this highway, Highway 85. And by the time I got to that highway, I finally relaxed because now I'm not in the wilderness anymore. I am on a major highway and there's people, but there weren't people because it was so late. There was only one car that would drive by about maybe every 5 minutes. And this is a four-lane highway. So that's when I started to realize, geez, this is really late. And then I hit the wall. I like bonked. I was exhausted. I felt like I'd run a marathon. So I'm riding my bike, doing the best I can just to keep it vertical. And I finally make it up this hill and I pull into the 7-Eleven. And there's a police car out in front. And he has his windows down. And I have to walk by him to get in the 7-Eleven because I'm also dying of thirst. I'm super dehydrated. And I go in. And I thought I heard my name as I was walking by the police car, but I kept going, and I went in and got some Gatorade, three big 32-ounce orange Gatorades, and I drank one before I even got to the counter. And I put a 20 on the counter, and I think I just left. I didn't even get the change or whatever. I'm not sure. But I remember leaving with the other two Gatorades and going outside. I left my bike against the windows. And the cop gets out of the car and comes up and says, excuse me, sir, is your name John Blitch? I said, yeah. He said, okay, well, I just want to let you know your wife has called out a missing persons report. And what I'd like to do is just, I'm going to call in that I've found you. And if you're up for it, I'd like to offer you a ride home. Now, usually, you know, the athlete's ego is, there's no way I'm taking a ride home from you, dude, right? But what I really said was, thank God. So I did, and he drove me home, and that was it. That was that event. That was that missing time. I don't know what time I got home. I did go look, not immediately, not until last year. I didn't even think of looking for a police report, but I did go back last year, and they couldn't find anything. Highlands Ranch, which used to be just this tiny little. Wasn't even a township. Now it's exploded. It's a city, and there's just too many police reports. They've purged everything, so I couldn't find it.
You'd never find it now, no.
Probably not.
We're going to take another break. We'll be right back. We're talking to John Blitch about some remarkable experiences and a remarkable life, a life that has touched the nuclear issue, a life devoted to helping others. And a life that has been interrupted at times in some fairly ways. You mentioned a red plaid shirt on the apparent. I'm assuming that's a screen memory. Of course, we don't know for sure. It could have just been, you know, you had a confused night. I mean, you know, but at the same time, there were women who used to show up in these red plaid clothing this at our cabin occasionally.
Your cabin?
Yes. I believe that the director of the communion film saw a group of them, and they wore red plaid shirt blouses and skirts, and they looked human, and they had absolutely no emotional affect at all. They did not compute.
Wow.
So,
wow.
I think you might have met one of those critters.
Well, so the plot thickens quite significantly.
Yeah.
Because two other things happened right around that time, and it's fuzzy. It was fuzzy. But the two other events that occurred right around that same time was, number one, I was late to link up with my wife and my older daughter. My younger daughter was with me, and we were supposed to meet them in a mall in Littleton, Colorado. And we ended up cutting through the Barnes & Noble's bookstore. And as I'm walking along, I happened to glance over to the wall of the bookstore, and there prominently displayed were 10 or 15 copies of your book, Communion. And Willie, you've probably heard this 1,000 times from other experiencers. I froze in my tracks. I was paralyzed with fear, and I just stared at that picture right there on that's over your left shoulder. And my daughter, what shook me out of it, my daughter went all the way out into the mall. She turned around and came back, and the next thing I know, she's grabbing my hand, dragging me. She's like, "Dad, come on, we're going to be late." And that shook me out of it. And so then we went and met my wife and my daughter, and they went clothes shopping, and I went straight back to that bookstore, bought the book, ripped the cover off of it, threw it in the trash can on my way out the door. And I think the clerk might have asked me something. "Don't you want to?" And I was out the door. Oh, I'm getting goosebumps. I gotta turn on the heater. I'm getting
Now, were there any, I believe on Ross Coulthart's show, you mentioned a bruising on your arm.
Yeah, that was a separate incident. That was totally separate. And that was, geez, 20 years later. But there was another event that occurred around the same time, this 1995 timeframe. And that was a dream that I now believe was not a dream. And that was this large grasshopper, praying mantis looking being that came in my, what I thought it had come through the screen door on our deck that was next to our master bedroom. It was a third story, no stairs, so it couldn't have been a human, right? It just, well, it could, I don't know. Anyway, it felt like it just walked right up to me and without even any hesitation through that door. And it was scolding me. It was complaining that I was wiggling around and screaming. And it was telling me, "Quit friggin' wiggling. Stop your screaming. We have told you 100 times, we're not going to hurt you. We got to do some work on your body, but your body is just a brain housing group. It's just a soul container. We can't hurt you, your soul. We can certainly hurt your body. We don't want to. We're
yes.
trying to help you. We're here to help you, but you got to stop this." And as an example of what he could do, his mandibles that were closed, they suddenly opened up, and these big jaws, like ant jaws, started tearing into my cheeks, my shoulders, and I could feel it. I could feel the tugs, and you know, tissue was flying, there's blood splattering, and this was just all mental imagery. And the whole time he was conveying to me that this is the kind of thing we could do to you if we wanted, but we still can't get to your soul. So I felt no pain, but it was like a visceral lesson that he was trying to impart to me. And that was it. That's all I remember from that dream. Many years later, after the morning, the other event where I had the bruises, I did, well, maybe I should tell the bruising story first, I guess.
Tell the bruising story first.
Okay. So that's That all of that that I just told you is what I remember consciously. There was never any meditation about it. There was never any hypnosis about it. Nothing like that. That's exactly how I remembered it all the way up until 2018. But in 2013, I had a very anomalous experience at another time. I was in grad school again. I was living alone. My next door neighbor, great guy, and I had come out of our houses because a storm, or it wasn't a, it was a cloud. It was a very weird, dark cloud. It looked like a hurricane, you know, what you see on TV. It had a big spiral, big black hole in the middle. And we're both looking up at it. And he yells over to me across about a half acre. So maybe 100 yards or so. And he's like, "Hey, are you seeing what I'm seeing?" I'm like, "Yeah, it looks kind of weird, doesn't it?" He goes, "Yeah." And it looks like the eye is directly over this lot between our two houses. I owned that lot, and he always wanted to buy it from me because he didn't want somebody else's house to ruin his view. And he was a great guy. I was never going to sell it to anybody else anyway. But he wanted to turn it into a mountain bike park for his kids. And so we talked a lot about that, and we used to mountain bike together, et cetera. And so the weird thing, though, and I know you're familiar with this, it's a common factor in this literature, you know, the invisible college literature where your books are. It's what I call irrational ambivalence, right? There are these weird environmental, behavioral activities that for some reason you don't follow up on. Even somebody with a modicum of curiosity should follow up on it.
Right, exactly. That happens to all of us all the time. And people, and you think to yourself, what in the world? Why didn't I say anything? Why didn't I? Was it nuts? Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah. I call it irrational ambivalence. And so the two of us, we just kind of, instead of waiting for the rain to fall, I don't even think there was any rain. I don't remember any rain. We just both went in our houses. We went back to our houses. And I remember shortly after that going into a procedure that I used to do as a kid, which is after those big black eyes, those horrific nightmares that I would have, I would go into like an OCD behavior, and I would go and make sure every single blind was absolutely closed. And the anomalous aspect of it is sometimes I would even go get Scotch tape and tape the curtains so that there wasn't any possibility that they could part. And so those eyes could look at me. It's just weird, right? And then you lock all the doors, you triple lock all the doors, typical OCD-like behavior. Yeah. And then I remember thinking, you know what? I know they're coming. I get that feeling, you know, that there's a shiver down the back of my spine. And I'm like, oh, crap. Here we go.
Yeah.
And now, the difference between this, now I'm about, I think I was around 50 years old, maybe a little older. And I had this sudden feeling that, you know what, there's nothing I can do. And that's what's terrifying about it, right? And I know you know that. I know I'm preaching to the choir here.
You have to live with it. You've got no choice because it's not going to
yeah.
go.
Yeah. So I told myself, you know what? Never mind trying to hide a knife under your pillow. Or in Terry Lovelace's case, he stole his dad's pistol and put his pistol up underneath his pillow.
Well, listen, I was big time gunned up at the cabin. I had a Benelli riot gun.
Yeah, wow. Wow.
Hardware.
Here's an independent corroboration for you. My dad had like 10 guns. I had no idea. After he passed away, I inherited them all. And so he had a very similar sort of obsession with it, you know, and I, it was, he rationalized it that There were bears where we would camp when we were camping up in the White Mountains. We would camp right in that same exact area where Betty and Barney Hill were taken all the time. Every other weekend, we were up there throughout my childhood. And so he would bring a pistol with him, a 45, a 44 Magnum. And he said it was for bears because, there were some Girl Scouts that got attacked or whatever. But I always wondered whether or not it was for something else. And maybe it was this. But in any case, I
In
went
any,
to bed. Go ahead, sorry.
no, go ahead. That's okay. In that area, I mean, that's an area where they see Bigfoot every once in a while too.
Yes, it's certainly rational just to bring a gun to protect your family, right?
Right.
But why would you buy a new gun every like 3 years? I don't know. It's just interesting.
It's guarding behavior. That
Yeah.
it,
Oh,
oh,
that's a great way to. Yeah.
guarding behavior. I did it too with my family. I mean, I used to sit outside my son's room with a shotgun in my hands and not know why I was doing it.
Yeah. That's a great term. I'm going to borrow that soundbite if you don't mind. I will quote you.
Right
Guarding
ahead.
behavior. That's perfect. Absolutely right. So, in any case, so I convinced myself. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Let's take another little break.
Okay.
We'll be right back. We're talking to John Blitch. It's a remarkable conversation. We'll be right back. We're talking to John Blitch, his remarkable experiences and an extraordinary career in the military and in other areas of the Defense Department, primarily involving helping areas of rescue operations, helping others, and on the side, having some pretty weird experiences in his personal life. Let's go on now because there's another one after that, and the one where you've got the bruises on your arm.
Yeah, so this is that same night. I just told myself, look, there's nothing you can do. Never mind this guarding behavior like you described. Just get it over with. So and as soon as I thought that, I was out. There was no tossing and turning. It was like boom, I'm asleep. The next morning I woke up and went straight downstairs to a box that hadn't been opened in 4 years and got a video camera out of it, put a battery in it, and marched myself right back upstairs, went straight into the bathroom and looked in the mirror and videotaped the inside of my right bicep. And there were three dark bruises on the inside of my bicep in kind of a triangle, a shallow triangle, and then a yellow bruise on the back of my tricep. Nothing on my left arm.
And you knew this that and you knew you needed to record it, and that's why you did this. You don't normally do that, though. It's not, it's usual behavior.
There's no reason that I would do that. Now, I'm no stranger to the gym, but I never did bodybuilding or any competitions or anything. I never filmed myself in the mirror or anything like that. And it was just, again, very anomalous behavior. And so at that point, I still don't know where that video is. I have probably 2 or 3 man years of videotapes from when I was doing robotics work, my search and rescue teams. So it's somewhere on one of those tapes. And so I'm going to have to hire somebody to go screen it all and find that thing. But again, irrational ambivalence. Why haven't I until recently expressed an interest and go back and look at that? It's just kind of weird. It feels like maybe
Now
there's a.
is the time,
Yeah.
John. It's all happening now.
Yeah.
Those four-finger bruises mean the graze, and that also means that you were under their control as soon as they touched you. And you talk about a few minutes ago of just suddenly going to sleep. That's when they touched you. And you didn't go to sleep. You went into another state, and you were turned off, is what happened. and they probably got you under control that way. And there's an energy's going into your body, which, if you could remember it, it would feel like an electricity kind of going into your body, and it would have made you completely helpless, except for what they were commanding you, your body to do. And
I'm getting chills as you're talking, right? It's so common.
you've never explored this, like with hypnosis or breathing techniques or anything. In other words, these are just natural memories at this point.
At this point, yes. But I did go back and I had a hypnosis session to explore the mountain bike ride. And what that revealed to me was absolutely stunning. Now, before I tell you what that revealed, I want to talk a little bit about the science of hypnosis because I spent a good part of my career digging into that. There are people that are way better versed in hypnosis than me. I suggest David Spiegel and his dad, Dr. Stanford psychiatrists. They came up with the Spiegel-Ayrault test to do a quick assessment of how hypnotizable different people are. Andrew Huberman has done podcasts. There's a bunch of folks that are better versed in it than me. But what I will tell you is that hypnosis, A, works. They will tell you that. Consult with them. It's very effective. In fact, Jesse Michaels was shocked when I told him that there were two inmates. This is about 3 years ago when Terry Lovelace and I were talking about this. At that time, there were two inmates on death row who were convicted in part by testimony and evidence gathered under hypnosis. I mean, hypnosis is used time and time again for legal purposes, both on the prosecutor side and the defense side. So there is science behind it. It's not junk science. It's not pseudoscience. It is very effective, but there are individual differences between different people. Some people, especially if you're very anxious, you're not going to do well under hypnosis, right? Unless you use it and gradually bring that level down. So anyway, I defer to Dr. Spiegel, Dr. Huberman, and a whole host of other folks about that. And I also want to point out that there's a wide variety of difference between a fully certified psychiatrist like David Spiegel, John Mack, or certified hypnotherapist like Leo Sprinkle and Yvonne Smith and Kathy Martin. Those folks are trained to make sure they don't ask leading questions,
Right.
that they use the right procedures, and they have a screening process. And if nothing else, you got to pay $300 an hour to do it, right? And so it's a self-screening mechanism. So I did not go to somebody on a lark that hadn't certified, hadn't trained. My first session was with Leo Sprinkle and then with Kathy Martin. And so what I discovered under hypnosis is that red plaid, well, first of all, the person in the cab of that truck was not a person.
I
It,
know that.
you knew this, you knew this, you know the whole screen memory thing, right? You knew this. I didn't know that. At that time, and this is an important aspect, at that time, I had no idea that there was any such thing as praying mantis beings reported by any other experiencer. I had read a lot of books by that point, and none of them had anything about a praying mantis. And so that's another reason why I thought it was a dream. All aliens are little gray guys. That was what was in my head.
Yeah.
Until much later, and then I started realizing, oh, maybe there are. Wow, there are other people that have reported these grasshopper praying mantis type beings. So, So what I discovered under hypnosis was that it wasn't a truck, that there was a tall being there, and that red color was not a plaid shirt. It was a uniform. And that was shocking to me. And that the dream about the praying mantis coming and, you know, giving me that mental imagery, that was not in my house. That was not in my bedroom. That was someplace else. But those two events were the same event. I thought they were separate. They were not. They were the same event. And so that's the only thing that I have discovered under hypnosis. I did have another experience at one point that I did with Yvonne Smith, and I was exploring an anomalous camping trip with my fiance, where we both woke up on a trailer. We had decided, again, one of these compulsion things. I had a big camper, nice warm camper. Why the heck would I sleep outside under the stars? Maybe for the novelty of it, I guess. And
we, opinions of those that were going to come after you.
Maybe so. I don't know. So we both woke up standing up. We don't remember getting out of our sleeping bags. We woke up standing up on the trailer, both of our dogs, my big old black Labrador Retriever and her little Boston Terrier. And we were staring at this light off in the distance, about 30 degrees off the horizon, maybe 100, between 100 and 200 meters away. And that's it. And I'm thinking to myself, why that's got to be a helicopter. You're outside in the vicinity of Yuma Proving Grounds, middle of the desert. And it was just weird. There's no noise. There's no dust kicking up. You know, nothing to indicate. It wasn't moving. It was just there. So while we're looking at it, we both, kind of like with me and Andy, my neighbor, we both look at each other like, huh, and we get back in our sleeping bags. It's just the weirdest doggone thing. So I was exploring that, and I suddenly got a pain in my knee. And I sort of realized that the reason for this memory loss was because it was not going to be a fun time. So I haven't gone back and explored anything else with hypnosis since, because what's the point? It's just going to induce pain. And I've already got these two very convincing episodes that convince me that not all visitors are grays, and that they're not bad. There was a gift that praying mantis guy gave me to make me realize that my soul is untouchable, no matter what you do to my body, right?
In many ways, that's the best thing that's been you've said in the whole show, because it's important to remember that, because the soul is our own, and the body is going to have all kinds of problems, and it eventually is going to die no matter what we do.
Right.
Come to the end of this part of the show. I want to take another brief break for our subscribers and those on the free side. I would urge you to subscribe to Unknown Country to keep this going. It's becoming more and more important as time goes on. And I wish I could say that I could reach out to you and show you how important it is, but I can't do that except to say, please go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. John Blitch about a remarkable life. I think John has opened up more about his experiences on this show than he ever has before, and certainly on anything you've done before, and that's appropriate because you're in the right place. This is Experiencer Central. And now let's move on, you've done a little hypnosis in an effort to unlock something about this. You've experienced this touch, and that's quite important. And I would suggest to you at some point you try to go back and see if you can really zero in on that moment, because it's buried somewhere in there, and you can probably gain a lot about it. Now, I wonder how this makes you feel, this whole thing, you know, the larger context, because it's a little bit, you know, some of us have gotten semen removed and eggs removed, and we've seen hybrids. I've seen and interacted with them many times, and they are harmed people, in my opinion. They're unvoiced, they're telepathic, they're extremely autistic, and they are not happy people. They're really struggling. And unlike the spellers who are in the human community and being given educations and treated and helped, they're in the wild. They're living in little enclaves here and there. So are we lab rats? What are we here? What's going on here, John? What is your impression of this?
Yeah, that's the impression I get, is that I was a lab rat. But I do have to say that, you know, looking back on especially the praying mantis event, that had a very positive influence on me, because I very shortly after that changed my entire thesis. My entire thesis went from designing a globe, a fiducial target that was going to go on the top of Rocky 7 for NASA to do sub-tense leapfrogging on the surface of Mars for navigational purposes, to a super right-hand turn into rescue robotics. There was no such thing as rescue robotics at that time, but the combination of my experience in Oklahoma City and this soul awakening thing just intensified my focus on rescue robotics from that point forward. And there's another aspect of my behavior that changed, which was from that point forward, I never killed another bug. I would go and it would bother my kids, right? I would say, "Stop! Go get a glass." So like, "Dad, go get a glass from the kitchen." They have to go all the way upstairs, get a piece of cardboard, and we'd put the glass on it, and I would escort them outside. Even like spiders or scorpions, I would do that with, right? And my wife's like, "Wait a minute, that thing can," you know. So it was a really interesting behavioral change. I went vegetarian a couple of times. I couldn't sustain it. And in fact, I had a doctor after I broke my leg, and it took 5 operations to save it. I'd love to give you some wonderfully heroic story, because it happened right after Katrina. I was down trying to use robots to help there. But the fact of the matter really is I was goofing around on a jet ski and I ran into a dock. And I broke my femur, and the problem was that they had to do a cut down to repair it, and it got infected. So it was a real problem. But the takeaway from all that is that I had this tendency to be very. I was always pretty animal friendly, but not towards insects. That's a different ballgame, right? And now I have this fascination that I won't let anybody kill bugs, and I don't want to eat meat. But then my doctor told me, "Look, it's coming down to this, dude. If you want to be a vegetarian for whatever reason, that's fine, but you're going to lose your leg." And a doctor told me that.
That's right, because you need that. You need that particular things in meat in order to heal. Absolutely, you do. If you don't have those things. I've forgotten exactly what it is in meat that makes it so important to heal bone, but you can't do that with a pure vegetarian diet. I'm in the same boat. I mean, I've been very blessed by the visitors in that they've laid out a lot of nutritional things for me, or if it is them, I'm never sure who it is, frankly. I mean, because I've got this implant, and stuff comes in through it, and often the advice is very good. And I, you know, so, but being a pure vegetarian has never been part of it. It's, you know, that's the choice I could make, I guess, if I wanted to. And I have at times, also like you. And I want to go on now to a question of we're getting into a situation now where a lot of powerful people, probably from the president on down, are exploring the idea of opening up what we have of the government's knowledge to the general public. And when I say what we have, there's a lot less available in the official record than there is in the defense industry. And the defense industry, I don't think, is necessarily going to be willing to give a lot of that up. But there's probably enough for us to, exactly, it's going to take money. There's probably enough for at some point, at some level of the government to say, yes, someone is here and it appears to be non-human intelligence. We're not there yet, and we've had now 14 administrations which would not go there. We're on the 15th. Donald Trump is the visitors, the Grays at least, love nominative determinism. That is to say, names that mean what the person is doing. A doctor cure-all or things like that. Donald Trump is overturning things. So it could be this is the administration that does it.
Could be.
Yeah, could easily be. Now, where do we take this within the government? Because you've got all these people like me, like you, and like so many others who have been abducted. What do we do to help the government get past this problem? Because after all, these people, including me, and possibly you have had the same experience and you don't remember, have been assaulted. And the government did nothing about it. In fact, it to an extent, social control was used to denigrate our experience. Now,
Absolutely.
how do we get to the point where we can reconcile and this can come out and it can be a strengthening process for everyone involved?
Yes, and thank you so much for that. That is absolutely the focus of my book that I mentioned to you a little bit when we were walking into Seoul. I don't know if you remember
To
that.
bring your book up, and I'm so glad I hit on this point because
This
it's
is perfect. Yeah. So for me, it's about forgiveness. It is a path to forgiveness, because for me, the abduction phenomenon is the elephant in the UAP room. Nobody is talking about that. And the reason is because of what you just said. It is absolutely terrifying. It is a violation of our rights as beings. I claim that every species has a universal right to protect their young, right? The polar bears that we used to sample, to determine what yield the Russian nuclear tests were doing in Siberia, they have a right to defend their cubs. So when we land our helicopter after tranquilizing them and we abduct them, they have a right to defend themselves against us. And so I claim that we have the same right to do that against those species, whichever ones they are, and it can be a splinter group. I do have some very compelling anecdotes to suggest that not all the grays are from Zeta Reticuli, and not all the ones that are from Zeta Reticuli, based on Betty and Barney, Betty Hill's star map that Marjorie Fish validated, what, 10 years after, several years after. In any case, look at the variability of behavior within our species, right?
Yes.
Within any single skin color or race on our planet. Got good and bad folks across skin colors.
Yeah,
So
but if we went to another planet, they would experience the Wild West for sure.
Yes, absolutely. So we got good and bad bugs. We got good and bad reptiles. We got good and bad gray guys. We got good and bad spindly white guys. So in the back of Richard Dolan's book, Alien Agendas, he's got like 30 different sketches of different beings that have been described by experiencers. My belief, again, belief, not knowledge, my belief is that we are in a galaxy teeming with life, and that all these visitors have different agendas. But some of them are galactic scientists who treat us like lab rats, and it is absolutely terrifying for us. And I believe the way that they're able to convince the galactic, whatever, the board, the institutional review board that approves their protocols, the way that they're able to get through that is to convince them that they can remove our memories so that we can live relatively normal lives. Now, they can't remove all of our memories. They just brief that. It briefs well to Congress, right? To their Congress, but they can remove most of them. And so we do have people like Terry Lovelace, like myself, like Bob Jacobs. Bob Jacobs went on to become a professor emeritus, right? Even after all of his stuff. And so my claim is that if we had all of our memories intact and they didn't tamper with them, we would be wallowing in our suffering so deeply we couldn't lead a regular life. And so my heart goes out to everybody who has suffered, especially if they are remembering more than me. And that is a traumatic experience. So my perspective, the way that I can connect all the dots in my little world is that yes, the government has known about the abduction phenomenon from way back. And you could argue, if you look at Jacques Vallée's, his literature over here, in addition to yours, and all the historic literature, we probably had abductions for millennia, right? Fairies and all the rest of that.
For a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence to support that, right? Or a lot of data to support that. So that, in my mind, that is at the core of this secrecy. It's at the core of the cover-up. Because look, lights in the sky, that's not scary enough to cause panic across society. And
Right.
even the notion that some of these objects, triangles, discs, diamonds, eggs, avocados, whatever, some of them have beings on them, that's not scary enough, right? Because maybe they're good folks, and there's plenty of evidence to support that. Look at Carl Higdon, taken in Wyoming. His tuberculosis was absolutely healed. David Pilates did an interview with him, and they showed his X-rays. So there are many, and I would say the vast majority, 99% of all these visitors are either benevolent or less than malevolent. But there's that core of us who have been kidnapped, and we have had our kids kidnapped, which is even more horrifying. Hence, as you wrote, what was the quote I was going to do? The guarding behavior, right?
Guarding behavior, yeah.
Yes, or guarding
Saw him
posture, maybe. Yeah.
with my own eyes.
Yes.
He came
Yeah.
back afterwards and wrote this incredible little essay about it at the age of 9, which I still have. But boy,
Wow.
I will tell you something that is hard. It's hard to stand out in your front yard and know your child is up there in that
Absolutely.
bright star up there.
Wow.
It, boy, I mean, they had people there to comfort me, not Grace, but some three men. And I'm not the only close encounter witness who's seen this.
Absolutely.
And we have to somehow or another come together as a community. And a big part of that is bringing the people inside the government who work on this, like Jake and David Grush and Lou, together with the people on the outside who are experiencing it. And you haven't worked directly on this, but you have experienced it, and you also have worked on many very sensitive programs in your career. So you're kind of a bridge individual. That's why I was so eager that you be the first to talk to me. And I'm hoping that the others will come and we'll build something, because no more than the individual could help the abductions, the government couldn't do a thing either. We weren't able to. They may have wanted to. I know that when in 1986, I guess it was, Dr. David Webb showed up in our life. Dr. Webb was a prominent space scientist. And if you look at for David W. Webb on Wikipedia, you'll see a whole laundry list of alphabet agencies he worked for. And he was quite frank with me and Ann about it. He said, I know perfectly well that this is happening. And he introduced us to an allergist who gave us epinephrine injectors because there were allergic reactions taking place. And he was very helpful. And communion, in fact, if you look at the frontispiece of it, you'll find it's dedicated in part to him. And that's, we need that bridge to be built so that when this begins to become public and the government can safely say, yes, this happened. Yes, people were abducted. No, we couldn't do anything about it, but we're here, and let's become a community again instead of being hiding stuff.
Yes. I believe that is why you're seeing this drip of disclosure that used to, we'd get a drip every 2 or 3 years, right?
Right.
And now we're getting them, it seems like we're getting them every month. You know, right. It's really sped up. It's almost a stream. And my claim, what makes sense to me is that now, thanks to some of the success in these crash retrieval reverse engineering programs, now we can defend a good portion of, not all. You can't defend every, there's no police force on the planet that can prevent murder across the board or rape across the board or kidnapping across the board. But we're a lot better at it now. And that's why I think we're on the verge of the government coming clean. And so this is what I'm trying to create with this book is, look, government, I forgave my parents for making me participate in the Santa Claus conspiracy, right? After my dad would lecture me about John Glenn. And now you're going to tell me this chubby guy is going to orbit the Earth and come on, Dad, this is bullshit, right? And so in order for me to forgive my dad, he had to come clean and say, yes, there is no Santa Claus, but don't tell your sister. Well, I don't have a good reason not to tell me. And so what I want my government to do, to me as an experiencer, is just come clean. You don't have to apologize even. You yeah. just got to come clean and admit it, that you couldn't protect us. It's difficult to do as a commander for me to stand in front of my guys and say, look, I screwed up. But so I'll tell you what Sergeant Major Robert O. Dean told me. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay. They didn't screw up. There was nothing to be done because they couldn't protect us. And but now we're in a different situation. We can interact with these entities in a way that establishes some borders, some boundaries. You know, years ago, and in fact, I think I mentioned it in my book, A New World, I had an interaction with the Greys about weapons. And of course,
you did. I remember that.
Yeah. And their attitude was, yeah, you need weapons because you need to be able to establish your own boundaries. And we don't want to colonize you culturally. We want you as an independent species. So yeah, We should have our own weapons. We don't have to go into this naked. We can go into this defending ourselves intelligently. And that means that the bad actors are going to have to watch out if they come around here.
Yes. And so I think that so my objective is to promote forgiveness. Three forms of it. Number one, forgive our government because they were doing the best they could to protect us from being kidnapped. And it's one of those things where you don't want to tell the kids that there's a child molester that moved in right across the street. You just tell them, stay away from Mr. Jones' house. But Dad, he pays me $50 to drive to shovel the drive. I don't care. Stay away from him, right? So there are secrets that, believe me, citizens of the United States, you don't want to know. It is very, very scary to embrace the notion that your kid could be taken out of your house and messed with. And most of the time, the vast majority of the time, 0.99, like 3 sigma of the time, he's returned and his memory's wiped and everything's good. And your memory wiped and everything's going to be okay. But you don't want to see that in action. You internalize some of that terror. So government, you got to come clean with that in order for me to forgive you. And I'm also going to forgive Dr. Bug or Mr. Bug or Mr. Grasshopper or Mr. Snake Guy or Reptilian or whatever. Because they're just trying to do the best they can. What if they have cancer and they're using us to test their cancer stuff like we do? We drop perfume on bunnies to see if it burns their skin, right? I mean, look at the way we treat our own animals. So,
and there's something about that, because after all, if you look at like the cattle abductions, the cattle mutilations, which I talk about in The Fourth Mind, because it became clear to me that because of certain things about the anatomy of the grays, they were clearly responsible for the cattle mutilations. And this is food for them. And they chose to take to fulfill their nutritional needs with the same food source we use. So, you know, people say, oh my God, the cattle mutilations are so terrible. I think, well, what about the slaughterhouses? You know, we do the same thing.
Right, right. And that's how they justified it to themselves.
But I can't apologize for the visitors, and I wouldn't do that, or for the government. But reconciliation is not about that. Reconciliation is about understanding and having insight. And we're going to get insight into the struggle that the government has had behind the scenes for so long, trying to understand and cope with the abduction phenomenon and a lot else. It's not the only thing, because there are other dark things as well. Also, we need to understand, and the visitors have got to come forward more about this. Why did they do it? What do they need so bad that they would come and sneak into our houses in the dead of the night and kidnap us to get it?
Well, again, this literature, the woo-woo literature, is full of explanations of that. They lost the ability to procreate. If you have cloned generations of your bodies, and and we're on the verge of doing this with AI, we're getting rid of emotion, right? If you have, and this is why it feeds into, maybe some of them are biological robots, right?
Biological robots, the ones that have been autopsied didn't have reproductive systems, the ones I know about. I mean, there may be others that did, that were autopsied, that I don't know about, but the ones I know about had no reproductive systems.
Therefore, there you go.
De facto, they were robots.
Yes. And so maybe they lost this emotional connection with each other and they want to get that back. And so they need to, we know we're a pretty emotional species, right? Compared to everything else on our planet that we're aware of. So there may be a component to that. But the third thing that I want to achieve with this book and I really want, I hope I can get to your listeners on this, is to forgive yourself. You, as a mom or a dad, you have been torturing yourself for not being able to protect your kids. You gotta let it go. And it's hard. It has destroyed families. And
Oh,
they don't understand that. How do we know that we didn't destroy that polar bear family, that those cubs rejected the mom because she didn't re because she couldn't or the mate. So this emotion thing, if they don't understand emotions, and we have a lot of cases of this, Whitley, I know you know this,
yeah. No, I
where
don't. Personal.
yeah. And so there are many cases where, the beings will wear masks or wigs because, and you ask them, take off that silly wig. You're
Yeah,
still
why was
just as scary.
out? I've seen that. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life.
So here's, but the narrative that goes along with those stories is, look, we know we scare you. We're just trying to calm you down. And we don't agree with what our fellow gray guys are doing. I have several stories of a hostage rescue operation conducted by ETs against other ETs, where a Marine on it, Preston Dennett tells one of these stories in one of his books, where he's laying on a table in a craft, a portal opens up. Two other beings come in, take him, and he's getting anxious. And they said, "Hang on, we don't agree with what's being done to you, so we're going to just bring you home." And then, boom, he wakes up. I've had other experiencers tell me that while their implant is being removed and they're screaming and swirling around, the ETs tell them, "We don't agree with who put this in you, so we're taking this out so they can't take you anymore." So there are many of those stories as well
Yeah.
that lead me to believe that there's this some sort of galactic structure involved in all this. But again, the three components of forgiveness are forgive them because they're just trying to protect themselves and better themselves and maybe get back their emotions. Forgive your government. As soon as the government comes clean, they got to come clean. They got to go open kimono, admit that this abduction thing is real, and then forgive yourself for not being able to protect your kids because you're asking too much of yourself.
Yeah, well, exactly. And yeah, also at some point we need to find out from the visitor level, the NHI level, why the abductions took place. In other words, I've got theories. Many of my colleagues who write books about this and have experiences have theories. We need it from them. We need their explanation for what they did. And we
Well,
need also these hybrids who are completely real. They need help. And they are scared to death, to be honest with you, terrified of us because, they have reason to be, I think. We need to be able to reach out to them. And that is the Greys who I think did this. Have got to help them find a place in our world.
yeah.
And we have to in the middle.
So Kathy Martin, Melanie Barton, and Denise Stoner wrote a book or have established this relationship with a sort of council of eight. And in that relationship, it was communicated to them that there are splinter groups of both the gray folks, the Zetas, and some of these other species that are simply not abiding by the Galactic Federation. They do their own thing. And so it's kind of an interesting issue as to how this might go. And unfortunately, we, as sort of I guess a subspecies, we like to put them all in one basket and say all the ETs are bad or all of them are good or all of them doing this.
Yes.
And so it's a mishmash of agendas.
Well, you know, as I said earlier, if we went to another planet, it would be a very good experience for them. This is more than one planet coming here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I mean, we can expect this to be a really tangled up situation, and it is. It
Right. So that's why I use the word not in the title of my book, the Abduction Amnesty Not, because knots are complicated. They can
Yeah.
be very complex. You know, you look at a monkey fist. I'm an amateur sailor now, so I'm learning all these nautical knots above my Boy Scout ones. And some are really hard to untie. And so it's not an easy problem to solve. But the first step in solving any problem is to acknowledge that there is a problem. And we know there is, because look how divided we are. So this has the potential, this whole issue has the potential to unite us. I posed the question to Jesse, imagine if we had a civil war after this last election. There was a lot of discussion about that, a lot of claims either way. And we had nuclear weapons in a red state and nuclear weapons in a blue state. Are we going to freaking nuke ourselves right here? I practiced that in 1983 in Germany. We had one part of the same country speaking the same language, and they were going to nuke each other. We are close to that. And so at what point are we going to back out and say, okay, well, that's ridiculous? Well, at what point are we going to back out and look at our planet as a nation state and say, okay, China, you got to agree you're not going to nuke Russia. Russia, you got to agree you're not going to nuke us. And let's get along like states, North Dakota, South Dakota. We got to zoom out and look at ourselves as a species and gather some unity in this thing. And so there's another. So you asked for a vision of current activity. I guess that's my claim, is I bleed purple and I want everybody else to, right? We got to look at ourselves as humans, and the realization, the announcement, not just here in this country, announcement across this globe, that there is a vast society of other beings out there that has the potential to unite us all.
Yes. Well, and President Reagan, he saw it
Yes.
as a threat. I'm not so sure that's the whole story, but it's part of the story, certainly. And he said, I occasionally think how quickly our differences would worldwide would vanish if we knew
Yep.
this was there. And, you know, it's time to know that there is something there, and part of it is a threat. Part of it is not a threat. Part of it cares. Part of it doesn't care, you know, and we're here all alone, essentially, on this little speck that is our home. And we belong first of all to each other. Then we belong to our countries. Then we belong to the world and to the universe. But we're going to go into this as a species, as mankind, as the human species, with all of our history and all of our potential and all of the extraordinary beauty of what it is to be human. This is what we have to take with us and never forget. And, you know, we're prettier than the grays for sure.
In our opinion, right?
Right. And maybe they're here for the hair. That could be the case. Or maybe for your hair. I don't know how much you've got left, but they're certainly not here for, uh-oh, we're out of the, you and I are soon going to be out of the running. Anyway, it's been great to be with you, John. I feel like we've been friends for life.
Yes, sir.
It has been beautiful, and we are going to do this. We will get to a point where the close encounter community, the governments, and those within the governments who have worked on this are all one unified group in the world taking this journey right out to the edge and beyond it, which is where we've always wanted to go.
I could not agree with you more. And I want to leave you with this. The best way to fight fear, in my opinion, is not to wrap yourself in a warm, cuddly little blanket and pretend there's nothing to be afraid of. That cocoon of warmth is comfortable, but that's not the way to fight fear. The way I propose to fight fear is you choke it out like an MMA fighter, and you do it with education. You go expand your mind, study what makes you afraid. And then once you do that, you realize, well, maybe just like you brought up Reagan, all those BMPs that we thought were impenetrable, we could penetrate the side of a BMP with a 7.62 machine gun. We realize, oh my God, it's not as bad as we thought. Every species has an Achilles heel. And so from a warrior perspective, educate yourself and go understand. And as Abraham Lincoln said, if I turn my adversaries into friends, have I not destroyed my enemies? And so my last point of optimism is with Marco Rubio, pro-disclosure, him being Secretary of State. Hopefully we can now get this out of the military's hands and start embracing this as a relationship between societies. And so I'm really optimistic about that. I'm very hopeful for that.
Well, me too. And so onward and upward, what a journey. Can you tell us before, I just want to know the title of your book. Have you got a title for it yet?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've got a cover of the whole deal. It's the Abduction Amnesty Knot, KNOT, A Path for Forgiveness in the Disclosure, A Path Toward Forgiveness in the Disclosure Age.
Wonderful. Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.